Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Dave.
And we're back with more theory.
Yay. I imagine this is like a, if this were a room full of students, they'd just be like, we're hoping at
Yep.
the end of the lecture, you like,
Well,
but.
I don't know about smiles, but hopefully you understand it at least.
That's why they're smiling.
Yeah, I guess so. All right.
You know, like,
Smiling.
I'm just, it's the hopeful side of me, I suppose. But for those folks that are like studying or whatever, and or maybe just having trouble with certain concepts, it's the opposite, right? There's the, I don't know what I'm reading. But anyway, geez.
Turn that frown upside down.
Oh my goodness. So we talked a lot about coag. We talked about platelets, vasculature, and we talked about secondary hemostasis, tertiary hemostasis, fibrinolysis. And so all the normal stuff is important to start with to build a foundation. And so today we're going to talk about a bit about pathophys involving platelets and bleeding disorders and things like that. So, cool. So, Melissa and I were talking briefly before. So, they're organized into two general umbrellas when it comes to platelets and having trouble with bleeding. We typically have qualitative disorders, which we'll spend a lot of time on today, and then quantitative, right? So,
I love this
quantitative.
because textbooks and teachers, we spend so much time talking about the qualitative platelet disorders, and you're probably never gonna see one. But the quantitative disorders, we're gonna be like, but it's the most common cause of bleeding.
Literally is, yeah. I mean, I can't refute that. Literally, that's like in a busy heme lab with like an oncology and or whatever, and then just even, intensive care units and things like that. Low platelets. It was low.
Ask
And
blood
that's the
bankers how many different types of patients have low platelets. There's going to be so
yep,
many.
it's a very long list. So yeah, it stands to reason that if you don't have a lot of platelets in relative concentration, it's more difficult to form that primary hemostatic plug. So I don't know, like maybe notable quantitative stuff, right? So like you said, there's a lot of reasons why it might be low. Maybe some of the ones that are worth mentioning, things like ITP. ITP is pretty common that we'll come across. So that's an immune-mediated removal of platelets from circulation. So, and is typically can be kind of like sporadic and but treated with steroids, sometimes patients respond well, their platelet count comes back up. Some are a bit more chronic and stubborn, right? And
We'll probably talk more about ITP later.
yeah, okay, fair enough. And then you can have like geez, trauma and all your platelets fall out because you were in a car accident or something like that, right? So they can be consumed in that way.
Well, then there's things like cancers or treatment
Sure.
of cancers. Those are probably like the biggest ones, depending on the patient population. But then, yeah, there'll be some congenital forms of thrombocytopenia. So it just there's so many reasons why it could be decreased. Platelets
Yeah.
could be decreased,
And then with
increased
our,
is
yeah,
a different bag of
increased.
worms.
And then our job is just to get that quantity and then for a clinical team to do their thing. So that's why they're less boring, but although they are the most common.
Yes.
So yeah, you have consumptive, destructive processes, and you have I don't make them, right, in terms
Right.
of the
For the
malignancies and things like
decreased
that.
platelets. And
Yeah.
then for malignancies, with increased platelets, those are like the myeloproliferative disorders, typically, like ET, the big one with platelets.
For the
But
increased ones, yeah.
yeah, for increased, ET is the big one, but any of the MPNs could have increased platelets because they're all characterized by increased cell lines. We'll talk more about MPNs in an MPN
Yeah.
episode.
That has its own bucket, really,
Yeah.
yeah.
The other thing would be reactive
Yes.
thrombocytosis. So
So
you,
pregnancy,
yeah.
right? All
Yeah.
these inflammatory conditions.
Basically inflammatory condition. So it's usually transient. It's usually during whatever the inflammatory thing is, and you usually don't have a loss or gain of function like you can with the more malignant types of thrombocytoses, like with ET, basically. And typically, the platelet count doesn't go over a million when we're talking about reactive, typically.
It is a good line to draw. Yeah. Yeah. I was also going to add that, like, if ever a test question is looking for a condition and you don't know what it is, just put pregnancy. You're welcome.
With
Anyway.
coag pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah. Pregnancy.
So I think that's the quantitative ones. Woo, that took us like 5 minutes.
Yeah. Pretty straightforward. Yeah, so and it's straightforward in that you don't have to think very hard to understand why not having a lot is causes like coagulopathy. So with these other qualitative, you're gonna have to bring some theory in here, and we're gonna have to think about concepts and things a little bit more in depth to understand why we have pathophysiology.
So before we jump too much into the quals, because that's gonna be a, you know, a whole most of this talk. When we talk about bleeding too, there's different types of bleeding.
There is.
So there's
There
more of like your mucocutaneous bleeds, you know, your nose bleeds, heavy menses, heavy menstruation. Easy bruising, nosebleeds, like those are more platelet or von Willebrand types of bleeds, or you know, decreased platelets or functionality, decreased functionality of platelets, or von Willebrand's disease sorts of bleeds. When we
as
think
opposed
about,
to.
as opposed to more of like the coagulopathies with like your coag factors, like hemophilia, things like that, those are more typically like deep tissue bleeds, anatomical bleeds, large joint bleeds. So typically your coag factor bleeds are more severe. Typically, there's the odd ones, like you could get severe bleeding with like Glanzmann's or like type 3 von Willebrand, but for the most part, platelet disorders are more of the mild bleeds.
So those categorization and of the bleeding can definitely be helpful.
Yeah, so that's helpful. And you know, we don't work with the patients, but if you're looking at a, you know, in special coag, we used to have to look to see like what are the patient's symptoms? What do they look like? So we would, if you look at the symptoms, then it's, you know, heavy menstruation, easy bruising. He's easy bruising and like nosebleeds and gum bleeds are much more common. Women don't, so like tangent, right? Women don't usually say I have heavy menses because how often do women, right? And if women, if you're listening, how often do you go to your friend and say, how was your menstruation today? How many tampons or pads did you go through? No one's going to have that conversation with family, friends, anyone. If anything, they're going to complain about having it and then complain about cramps or headache or whatever. But they don't usually talk about like how heavy is your menstruation? How many pads do you go through? So there, and a lot of times these are inherited conditions, right? So even if you are talking about it, your mom was like, yeah, I had the same thing, and then the grandma was like, I had the same thing, and then you're like, whatever, this is normal, when it's really not. So you know, it's up to the physician to be like, okay, well, how many pads and tampons do you go through? And some, that's why sometimes physicians ask that. I know women, we might think like, this is weird, why are you asking me? But That is why they're asking to judge, do you actually have heavy menstruation or do you have normal-ish menstruation?
Yeah, it's definitely a difficult piece of like the healthcare team to gather data that the layperson may not understand will be really important in formulating a differential diagnosis. So yeah, don't ever be embarrassed or that you need to hide anything from your doctor. So I often people will like kind of ask about medical professionals and like, is this a good doctor? People ask me that. And I always follow up with like, are you comfortable with them? I like the best doctor, the best primary care physician is one that you're like comfortable with, comfortable talking to. It's literally gonna do the most for you. So yeah, that patient presentation is very, very important. And yeah, a responsible coagulation specialist on the bench is gonna look in the history, right? Take a look at medications and things like that. All of these things are gonna feed in, you know, how many different medications mess with platelets, Melissa? I'm asking because I have no idea.
A good number.
Yeah, so the, so all that stuff is really, really important.
All right, so back to quals now, qualitative platelet disorders.
So I have a little list in front of me. I don't know how you
Do you
you
think we
got
need
your
the
own list.
whiteboard or do you want to just chat?
It's up to you. It's up to you. I think there'd probably be times. I think when we're talking about some of the receptors,
Love
and then
receptors.
depending on the depending on the depth that you'd like to go in, you know.
All right, let's bring it up. Bring up a whiteboard. So go ahead. What is your list that you have, Dave?
So the very tippy top of my list is Glanzmann's or disorders of 2B3A. So if we try to kind of think back to 2B3A's function, right? So as I recall, so I'm talking here, but I'm the worst coagulation person of the two of us by a fair margin. But so I remember 2B3A's function being revolving mostly around the aggregation piece of it. So 2B3A binds fibrinogen, which binds other platelets to B3A. And that's that kind of cross-linking of these cells that's going to end up causing the primary hemostatic plug. So 2B3A, very, very important.
Yeah. So let's talk briefly, like, so that's definitely that's a function of 2B3A. And remember, 2B3A is a platelet receptor. So it's sitting on the platelet surface. But remember that 2B3A is inactive until the platelet becomes activated. Once you activate the receptor, then it's there and ready to do its function. But when before you, if you don't activate the platelet, it's just kind of sitting there in its inactive form. And then once you activate the platelet, one of the things is the 2B3A receptor becomes really there and active. And then
Yeah,
it
but
can go through the process of binding to things like fibrinogen. So fibrinogen has this RGD, it has a specific amino acid sequence on the molecule, but other things like von Willebrand's share that same RGD sequence. So other things can bridge the basically aggregation. Fibrinogen is the primary bridge, the primary bridger between 2B3As, but other things can. Anything that has that RGD sequence can, that amino acid sequence can bridge 2B3A binding.
yeah, to go into like a more granular detail, the glycoproteins 2B and 3A are like just hanging out. They're not necessarily like buddies until they need to be buddies. Is that accurate? So, you know, there's a point at which knowing more is nice. And then like you can kind of like maybe it's not as helpful for like the board certification and things like that. So we'll try to give you like pieces here or there. I'm gonna give you baseline competency, and then I'll probe Melissa a little bit to maybe get a little deeper where it feels like We
I'll get
should.
excited and share too much, and Dave will rein me in.
I'll try to pull it back, yeah. For the norm, I'm representing the normies on COAG. So yeah, 2B3A, and so some folks are deficient in this, and I imagine there's a bunch of different genotypes that lead to the phenotype of Klansmans, right? So I'm like a broken record with my students on genotypes and phenotypes. But most of when we talk about these disorders, we're going to talk about a phenotypic presentation. But, perhaps some patients have the 2B part is messed up, and perhaps some patients it's the 3A or something intermediary process that makes them kind of become. So there's a lot of different ways you can mess up the genes to then have a functional 2B3A issue. So.
Yes, and then patients can also be heterozygous or homozygous for the disease.
Yeah, very good, right?
So heterozygotes, they're going to be phenotypically relatively normal because they still have 50% activity, 50-ish percent activity of their receptor. Whereas our homozygotes, they're going to be the ones that express the bleeding disorder.
That's really fascinating, right?
And again, it really does depend on the genetic mutation, because does the genetic mutation lead to a complete loss of functionality? Or does it lead to decreased functionality? It's still functioning, but at a significantly slower rate or a significantly decreased. So it depends on what the genetic mutation is that the patient experiences, dictates the functionality of the receptor. Either way, unlike with your adhesion receptors, there's only one aggregation receptor. So it doesn't matter whether you're trying to bind to fibrinogen or von Willebrand's or any of those other molecules, the receptors aren't working.
Yeah, and you can have robust activation, right? And just and it just won't matter. It won't amount to a hill of beans. So should we talk about testing? Yeah. So one of the classic tests in assessing platelet functionality is the platelet aggregation tests. So some folks may have used it, maybe, but aggregometers are really neat little machines, right? So they're one part spectrophotometer, sort of, right?
It's basically a big spec.
Yeah, it is, right? And nicer ones can look at many wells kind of all at the same time, right? But there might be a variable amount of ability there. But the idea is that you'll have a cuvette with platelet-rich plasma. Platelet-rich plasma, a little detour, is so our blue tops are spun at a slower force, or a lower force, I should say. And what that'll produce is cells are, the red cells and things are out, but platelets are still semi-suspended. So that's good. That's exactly what we want. And typically these have like a stirring mechanism. And the spectrophotometer is monitoring essentially the turbidity. Is that a fair way to put it? Right. And so the technologists will introduce different agonists, different chemicals that are going to interact with receptors. And, we have ADP, collagen, thrombin, epinephrine, arachidonic acid. Help me. It's probably most of them. Anywho, so all of those different agonists will interact with different receptors and produce, now a platelet will go through its normal physiological response of like secretion and activation. They get their phospholipid flip. And if they have intact 2B3A receptors, right, they will eventually aggregate. When they aggregate, the spectrophotometer sees this increased turbidity, right? These tiny, tiny microscopic particles that were far apart from each other are now in big blobs and clumps. And so we get a reading that kind of illustrates the turbidity. So when it comes to 2B3A, the classic aggregometer pattern is to have no reactivity in any of the wells, but for risdiceatin. So risdiceatin, you will have aggregation. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about risdiceatin when we start talking about 1B95 and thing, von Willebrand. What's that thing called?
Well, so let's back up for a second. So PRP, platelet-rich plasma, you told us how to get it.
Yep.
So it should ideally have a platelet count of about 250,000.
Yeah, very good, right? So we typically run counts on this because, geez, if someone's got a quantity deficiency, this is an excellent point, you won't know. So you need to know that first. There's need to know those platelets. Good.
Yes. So we need to have PRP, the platelet-rich plasma, with a count of about 250,000. Anywhere from about 100 up to about 500 could be done on a platelet aggregometer. When we're talking about the platelet-rich plasma platelet aggregometry, there's also whole blood aggregometry, and this is a whole different procedure. So we're talking about PRP method. So yes, we ideally want 250 for a platelet count. Each platelet aggregometer will have its own range. So you can do it up to 600 or whatever, but each procedure will tell you. And so you get your platelet count, but then you're going to take your parent tube, right? The tube that still has the red blood cells and a little bit of plasma left, and you put that back in the centrifuge, and then you're going to spin it high for a longer amount of time so that you can get platelet poor plasma, because that's your blank. Remember, we said it's a giant speck, so you have to have a blank. So we have platelet poor plasma, PPP, and that's our blank. So you blank, and you want to do the PPP for each specimen that you're doing, because everybody's plasma is going to be a slightly different color.
Absolutely, yeah. And what's beautiful about that is that it's all coming from the same tube.
Yes.
So there can be a bit of, you know, obviously hemolyzed specimens and things like that, not great for coag, but there's going to be some degree of variability in collection. So that's good to be able to do mm-hmm. that. And typically, there's lots of tubes too, right? I mean,
oh yeah.
Yeah, so
depending on the number of agonists, you definitely want to have a minimum of two tubes, and that doesn't allow for repeats, but three or four tubes is definitely ideal.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because remember, half the volume is red cells. You can't even use that, right? So, cool.
Yes, so this is getting our platelet aggregation pattern. And then the only other thing I wanted to mention is an agonist is essentially a chemical that's going to bind onto one of the receptors. And then Dave listed them, which they're here. ADP, collagen, epi, thrombin, risto, and arachidonic. So ADP, collagen, epinephrine, thrombin, and arachidonic are all agonists that you're going to find in vivo as well.
Yes.
Risdiceatin was an antibiotic that came out on the markets in the 80s, and they found that it caused agglutination of your platelets, and so they pulled it off the market. But hey, risto is great to use for platelet aggregation, and like Dave said, 1B95, because it causes agglutination of the 1B95 receptors.
So 2B3A, rewinding, is to facilitate that platelet. 1B95 can bind to von Willebrand's factor and cause like an aggregation response in and of itself, absent 2B3A. And so in the presence of risdiceatin, we have so the classic pattern, I'm saying, just talking here, is risdiceatin, you get aggregation, and then ADP, collagen, epinephrine, thrombin, or arachidonic acid, you get no activity. That's a classic Glanzmann's. And that's the only one I know.
but that's why you get activity with risdiceatin, is because it's agglutination of your 1B95 receptors, and it has nothing to do with your 2B3A receptor.
Right.
So that's why risto is normal when we're dealing with Glanzmann's, because your 1B95 receptor is fine. But all the other ones, you need an aggregation to happen. And so that's why they're all flatlined, because aggregation can't happen.
Yep.
So, or they're all maybe a little bit of activity.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Yeah. And that speaks to, you can have a Glanzmann's that's profoundly
yeah.
inactive, and then some that is, you get this like it's sort of working but it's yes. lazy. Yeah. You really have to kind of dig into chemistry a little bit and think about like affinities, right? So someone's 2B3A can just have like a loss of affinity, but it still works, but it's not as like maybe strong. So variable response. But generally speaking, with a procedure like platelet aggregometry, you're going to have cutoffs of percent activity that the lab's going to say, you know, not active, active. Or, and we actually, I think we reported them, didn't we? I think we did report activity. But what the normal range is it's quite variable, right? So, yeah.
Okay.
Anything else we can add to Glanzmann's?
And do we really, I mean, treating Glanzmann's?
Not my cup of tea on yeah, the therapy really, side.
We don't really do that aspect of it, but I mean, guess these patients can have bigger bleeds than dealing with like adhesion receptor issues just because aggregation.
Yeah.
So these patients can definitely have more severe bleeds. So these patients may have bleeding symptoms that are a little bit more severe than what we typically see with platelets. So, you know, it could look similar depending again on the mutation, but if we're dealing with a homozygote, it could look more like hemophilia-esque than platelet-esque. But then when you actually look at, you know, if you go down that route, you would do the testing and look for factor VIII's normal, factor IX's normal, factor XI's normal. Geez, what's going on? Well, let's look at this, you know, and then it's where you're going to get to having the platelets and then testing them. The other thing that I just remembered that I do want to point out is that your platelet count is normal with Glanzmann's, because that's going to be a big differentiator when we're talking about the 1B95 receptor disease.
Yep.
Okay, so I'm going to write that here. Platelet is normal. Platelet.
Yeah.
Count normal.
Like treatment wise, like you can what transfuse platelets, like, so you know that's an option.
Yeah, that's basically transfused platelets. Here you go. Here's some normal functioning platelets. It doesn't matter what the platelet count is if they're not functioning.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I think that's big thing for Glanzmann's is really knowing the aggregation pattern.
Yeah. Aggregation pattern, 2B3A. Like, we spent a lot of time here, but
yeah,
you know, yeah. Just remember, risdiplam associate with the 1B95, and you'll be good. Yeah.
Okay.
So I remember this one because it's easy to kind of logic through a little bit. It's the always how it works for me.
What's your next one on your list?
Speaking of 1B95,
I figured that might be next.
Yeah, so the next one is clinically we termed Bernard-Soulier syndrome, also called giant platelet syndrome. And so this is a defect in the 1B95 function. And so we got three different glycoproteins involved in this receptor, right? And if I remember correctly, it's redundant. It's several copies of some of these glycoproteins too.
Yes.
So,
we've got glycoprotein 1B9 and 5, and it's actually 1B alpha, 1B beta, 9, and 5, and they are found in a ratio of 2 to 2 to 2 to 1.
Yeah.
Normally, so these guys all hang out. So 1B alpha and 1B beta are both really important because that's where you're going to get von Willebrand's binding and then sending the signal into the platelet that you need to activate the platelet. 9 is a structural glycoprotein that's going to help kind of structure and anchor the 1Bs, and 5 is useless. So if you have a genetic mutation in 5, it does not lead to Bernard-Soulier syndrome. That's why we know 5 is useless. So, you know, a lot of times people just call it the 1B9 receptor and just drop 5 off because it's not actually super important. But most of your mutations are going to be in 1B alpha. You can have some N1 be alpha, beta, or 9 and develop Bernard-Soulier syndrome.
This particular receptor's physiological function, if we remember, is to bind to von Willebrand factor. A bit of a review for von Willebrand factor. I like to think of von Willis as a variable length like carpets, right? And if we imagine in areas of high blood flow, so high shearing forces, this is very advantageous to have a molecule with a wide or a large surface area that can bind to exposed collagen, subendothelial collagen, and then provide a decent runway, so to speak, for platelets to interact with. So I imagine the platelet binding onto the von Willebrand factor and kind of rolling down von Willebrand factor, like slowing down and then catching, right? And so 1B95 is the receptor on the platelet that is going to interact with its corresponding receptor on von Willebrand factor.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So does that jive for you?
Yes, and a lot of times they call Bernard-Soulier syndrome the sister disease to von Willebrand's disease because BSS is an issue with the receptor on the platelet, and von Willebrand's disease is an issue with the ligand for that receptor, right? Von Willi is the ligand, the protein that binds to 1B95. So if you have von Willebrand's disease, you have an issue with the protein, and if you have Bernard-Soulier, you have an issue with the receptor.
Clinically, presentation very similar between those two disorders, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the aggregation pattern can be similar then to, not always, but it can be similar depending on the subtype of von Willi.
I want to back up a little bit too, because we also called this, it's been called giant platelet syndrome, right? So giant platelet syndrome, what? What's going on there?
So these patients are going to have decreased platelets, typically, and they're going to have giant platelets. Giant, sometimes large rather than giant. Remember, the definition of giant is going to be larger than red cells. And sometimes these platelets are not quite larger than red cells, but they're going to be significantly larger than normal size platelets. So we get both giant platelets and a decrease in the platelet count in Bernard-Soulier. And again, comparing that to Glanzmann's, you don't have either of those. You have normal platelets morphologically and in numbers in Glanzmann's.
It like almost seems like you're making similar amounts of platelet volume, but the patient doesn't. I'm trying to think
you're
of
cutting them. Basically, if you have different, think of it as like cookie cutters, because when megakaryocytes form their demarcation system in the cytoplasm, you're essentially having like a cookie cutter. The megakaryocyte goes along and says, these are going to be where my platelets are outlined. And with Bernard-Soulier, you just have a significantly larger cookie cutter. So you have the same amount of cytoplasm, but a larger cookie cutter. So you're getting larger platelets.
Yep. So now on the aggregation side of this, we could probably good time to talk about the testing. So it's literally the inverse of Glanzmann's, right? Mm-hmm. So these are mirrored in their laboratory assessment. So because 2B3A is intact, because there's no problem with the agonist receptors, that ADP, collagen, epinephrine, all the greatest hits, right? They will still activate platelets, and then they'll still be able to aggregate with one another. So we're going to get good, robust activity across all agonists except for risdiplam. So now risdiplam will display low or no activity. And that implies either a deficiency in von Willebrand's or a 1B95 issue.
Von Willebrand's is far more common.
Yes, yes, that's a good point too, right? So the differential diagnosis would go von Willebrand's, and Bernard Soulier, I imagine the next thing to order is von Willebrand's testing, right?
Well,
So
and a
we
lot of
have.
times, especially pediatric oncologists, they order aggregations with von Willebrand
Yeah.
screens.
Because, right?
It's
Like,
my,
you're gonna need that data point. And then oftentimes this patients are being referred, right? So we're at like a heme doc. They know we have a bleeding disorder. Let's gather all the data all together and look at it.
Yeah, and I mean, think about it. So Bernard Soulier, remember we said it, how it still has thrombocytopenia. Well, if you have normal von Willebrand, well, normal, if you have type 1 von Willebrand's, which is by far the most common subtype of von Willebrand's, those patients don't usually have thrombocytopenia, but there are subtypes of von Willi that do have thrombocytopenia. So just because there's thrombocytopenia doesn't make them lean more towards BSS.
Okay. Fair enough. So what else can we say about Bernard Soulier?
So, I guess it's also heterozygous homozygous. So, patients heterozygotes will still have normal functionality. Homozygotes will have bleeds, but they're not as severe as Glanzmann's, in part because this is an adhesion and not an aggregation receptor. So, if you can if you can activate a platelet by other means, which you can, then you can still go through aggregation and still go through that process. You just can't go through adhesion through this one receptor. So remember, you can still activate platelets. You can still go through adhesion with your collagen receptors. So the adhesion process happening in areas of low shear flow rates is going to happen mostly with collagen receptors anyway. So those aren't going to be as impacted. It's the adhesion that's happening in the high shear flow rates areas where you really need to utilize the 1B95 receptor and von Willebrand's that's going to be more impacted in these patients. So they'll still have bleeds, but it's not going to be anywhere near as severe as Glanzmann's because there are other means for adhesion. I mean, you can still treat with platelets and stuff like that if you need to.
Well, I think we covered all the big stuff there.
I think so too.
B95. Going down my list here. So, but has disorders of it has inherited giant platelet syndromes is like. So I don't know if it's worth spending time on things like May-Hegglin, right? So there are some. So the fun thing about heme, it's super awesome, is that a bunch of these hematological disorders like overlap in weird ways and have features that are platelet related, but it's really not like what the disorder is all about. So May-Hegglin,
So May-Hegglin, and then we'll also have things like Chediak-Higashi and
yeah.
Hermansky-Pudlak syndrome. Those are more like May-Hegglin, Chediak-Higashi, those are more like benign white cell abnormality disorders that also have platelets involved.
Yeah.
So
And so,
think those fit better under white cell abnormalities.
I agree with you. Yeah. So quick mention, but yeah. So the next on the list then goes to our storage pool diseases. So so defects in our alpha granule storage. So I would say this is where I'm like a little like meh.
Most people are a little meh because they are in general a little meh. So I think alpha granule deficiency, which is gray platelet syndrome, that's probably the most defined, the most it's more of a coag thing because a lot of times the dense granule deficiencies, that's where you go into like Hermansky-Pudlak and like those
The
weirder
weird, yeah, the
diseases
weird ones.
that are not really hematologic. So alpha granule deficiency is basically you lack alpha granules. And if anybody remembers alpha granules, there's like 50 to 80 per platelet. And those are, when you're looking at a right smear, those are the purple granules that you see in the cytoplasm. But you lack those in alpha granule deficiency. That's why they call it gray platelet syndrome, because there's just a bluish gray blob of cytoplasm left. So
Yeah,
you
and so
lack.
that's useful, right?
Yes. So you lack all of the things that are found in alpha granules. So remember, alpha granules have things that are synthesized within the megakaryocyte. So that could be things like von Willebrands are going to be stored there that are synthesized by the platelet. But then you're also going to have things that are endocytosed by the megakaryocyte in the platelet that are stored in the alpha granules, like factor five and other things. So you lack all of that within your platelets. So when you activate the platelet, they can still release dense granules if they have the dense granules. If we're just dealing with a gray platelet syndrome, they do have dense granules, but they're not going to be able to release that burst of all of those coag things that need to be bursted into the area where there is coagulation happening.
Like a lazy response, right?
Yeah, it's still. Alpha granule deficiency isn't that big of a deal. It's very mild. Again, it's not one of those severe ones. None of the storage pool disorders are, in general, not severe bleeds at all. They're all fairly mild.
Yeah, so and then even the aggregation patterns associated with these can be a bit variable too, right,
Those,
Melissa?
yep, those will vary, which makes it
So
hard.
yeah.
I think textbooks will tell you certain things, like epinephrine is going to be impacted, arachidonic might be impacted, ADP is more impacted when you have a dense granule deficiency. So it'll vary, but the textbooks might give you an aggregation pattern.
So yeah, then we have sort of like a an other categorization. Collagen receptor, ADP receptor. Yeah, so these are quite, now we're getting into kind of like really rare
We're getting
and
into the weeds.
yeah, absolutely into the weeds.
Or, as my husband would say, we're looking at zebras and not horses. It really, it like the big platelet disorders. Qualitatively, are Bernard-Soulier and Glanzmann's,
Yep. And then if
and then
we
von
wanted to
Willebrand.
talk about so then this particular reference I'm looking at ends with acquired. And so this is kind of looking at drugs and what some of these drugs can kind of do to platelet receptors and activation. So I don't know if that's a fruitful place for us to take this or if it belongs in another video. What do you think, Melissa?
Either way, I think we can. Well, let's just throw it in here. Why not? We'll talk about
Yeah,
acquireds.
fair enough.
Yeah, I was just trying to write on my mouse pad with my pen. It doesn't work that way. We'll listen. All right.
So I
So
have a
these
list of
are
drugs here.
acquired qualitative, right?
Yes.
Okay. What you got?
So we have a drug and then it lists a target. So that might be a good way to kind of organize some of
Okay.
these. So the very first drug is aspirin, good old aspirin. And so it inhibits cyclooxygenase, so known as COX, COX.
COX-1, the
So,
COX-1 inhibitor.
yep. So if my theory is sound and I remember accurately here, cyclooxygenase is involved in our production. So that's where we have arachidonic acid becoming our thromboxane eventually, right? Is that the end product there? Yeah. And thromboxane is sort of a huge recruiter molecule for other platelets and things like that. So aspirin is listed as an irreversible cyclooxygenase inhibitor.
Yes. So with this pathway, it's the eicosanoid synthesis pathway,
Yeah, that's what it's called.
where you go from taking some of the phospholipid from the platelet membrane and is that eventually creating arachidonic acid, and a cyclooxygenase acts on arachidonic acid to make it into eventually either thromboxane or one of our prostacyclines. And so your thromboxane promotes platelet activation and the whole process, whereas your prostacyclines depress it. They suppress it. And it all has to do with the amount of cyclic AMP that's being released into the platelet, whether you're activating or suppressing. So it's irreversible because platelets are enucleate. If platelets had their nucleus, they could just synthesize more cyclooxygenase. But because they cannot, this is an irreversible thing because it just binds up all of the cyclooxygenase that's present in the platelet, and you can no longer activate the platelet via the eicosanoid synthesis pathway. Endothelial cells within the vasculature, they have COX-2, cyclooxygenase 2, and they go through the eicosanoid synthesis pathway, but the endothelial cells typically make our prostacyclines, so they can help suppress platelet activation, which is one of the big things that endothelial cells do to, depress abnormal thrombosis. And so when we take aspirin, it can also bind onto their cyclooxygenase, but because they have a nucleus, they can just make more. So that's the difference. Aspirin is a cyclooxygenase inhibitor, but because platelets don't have a nucleus and can't make any more, it is for the lifespan of the platelet. And keep in mind, we're only suppressing activation of the platelet via this one pathway. There are many pathways to activate a platelet.
So aspirin is usually the first line of defense against stroke and things, especially with people with high risk factors or history. Aspirin has been a wonderful drug throughout the years in terms of mitigating inappropriate thromboses and things.
Well, let's add one more column here, even too, is what agonist is it going to impact then? So if you did a platelet aggregation assay, this would impact arachidonic acid. So you would have an aggregation pattern and you would have normal aggregation for almost everything else. It can impact epinephrine a little bit too, but really the biggest impact is going to be arachidonic. And depending on when the patient took the aspirin. So if the patient just took the aspirin, it's probably going to be something like that for arachidonic. But if the patient has been, it's on day 7 and you've got a whole new group of platelets coming out, it might be more like this, where you have some activity, but not a lot. But so it depends on when the patient took the aspirin, the activity that we're going to see. But we're going to see the impacts mostly in arachidonic acid.
The next drug that's listed here is naproxen, ibuprofen. So these are listed as reversible
Yes,
COX
yes.
inhibitors.
Yep. So they are only for the lifespan of the ibuprofen, which is about 8 hours. So they'll bind
Cool.
onto the COX and then release it.
And then we start to get into kind of the more interesting therapeutics.
What do we got? The thiopyridines? Yeah.
Clopidogrel.
Yep. So there's a bunch
Thanks.
of these, clopidogrel, there's several others. And we're talking all about drug names, not brand names, because like clopidogrel is Plavix. But clopidogrel is the drug name. So there's several other drugs that do the same thing, and they're called the thiopyridines. I don't know that I can spell it, but I will try.
I won't judge you. And so these act on the P2Y12 receptors. And the P2Y12 is what interacts with ADP. ADP is an excellent agonist for platelets and recruiting platelets.
Yeah. So if you think about platelets, there's P2Y12 and P2Y1. These are the ADP receptors that we find on platelets. And P2Y12 has significantly more receptors on the platelet surface than P2Y1. So that's why the thiopyridines target P2Y12 and not P2Y1, because you're much more likely to activate the platelet with ADP via P2Y12 than one. So these guys target P2Y12. So you theoretically still could activate the platelet with ADP via P2Y1 receptor. However, the thiopyridines are very effective. And so far, the three of these are oral antiplatelet drugs.
Yeah, and so, and then I'm kind of sort of thinking like that's not a bad place to end it. So some of these other drugs, Vorapaxar is a thrombin PAR receptor inhibitor.
Some of and these, like that one's not widely used.
Right. These are more niche now applications, right?
Yeah. I think the only other one that has wide application would be the 2B3A inhibitors.
Yeah, and that was the next one I was going to go to, yeah.
There's a couple of other ones, like there's dipyridamole and Agranox and a few other that are like mixes of drugs. But really, aspirin and the thiopyridines, that's like the big antiplatelets. So like if a patient has any issues with strokes or heart attacks or anything, they're typically going to go on aspirin and Plavix or aspirin and the thiopyridines together, because now you're inhibiting platelet activation via multiple pathways. And then if you need to monitor, you can monitor either by doing, you know, a platelet aggregation, or there's also other assays out there that can do rapid platelet testing for drugs like aspirin, the thiopyridines, and then the 2B3A inhibitors. So, but 2B3A inhibitors, so they target 2B3A, glycoprotein 2B3A.
State, right?
Yeah, they put the patient basically in a Glanzmann's thrombocythemia-like state. It's widely controlled, and I believe it's an IV drug, right? You have to be in the hospital to be on a 2B3A inhibitor. But it targets basically all agonists, all receptors, except for Aristo.
Yeah, we basically wrap up here with now a bunch of different non-coag disorders that affect platelets. So multiple myeloma with its malignant paraproteins, MPNs, and their sort of complicated interaction with hemostasis, liver disease, uremia, sort of things like that. So some of these other disorders are disrupting the broader environment of the body and then cause issues with platelet interaction and activation and aggregation, things like that. But I don't know that they're worth kind of banging the drum on. They're kind of their own thing.
The only one that's worth it is liver disease, but I think that's a different discussion for a different day.
Yeah, fair enough.
Because that also impacts like secondary hemostasis, coag. So I think that'll be a liver disease discussion.
Yeah. And then, but platelets maybe, right? But yes. Yeah, it's more
well, it's not an but platelets, it's platelets too, but it's,
yeah,
it's a bigger discussion.
I'll stop it there. I started to just get curious, and this isn't the place for it, Dave. Cool. So that is, so we talked a bit about quantitative, and we talked a lot about qualitative disorders of platelets.
Both inherited and acquired.
Right. Yep, exactly. So a lot of stuff there. And like we said, most often platelet-related bleeding is quantitative in nature and probably not even related to the platelets at all. So
in practice, in theory, you got to know it all.
Yeah. And those end up being the fun ones, honestly, right? It's kind of boring when it's just a low platelet. Like that's
right. We went from
yeah. So hopefully everyone's smiling at this point in our series. So cool. Think we're good there? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's great. That's all we've got for this one. So thanks for listening.
Thanks for your time.